We have today someone that has written a marvelous book, just an in-depth, infuriating look at Fast and Furious, Barack Obama's bloodiest scandal and its shameless cover-up. And the author, Katie Pavlik, is with us. She's been kind enough to join us for an hour today to discuss Fast and Furious and share things that most people have no idea, have no clue of what was going on. Also, the book itself gives a very in-depth and critical look at how things work in government. And many people have felt that this is the way things are, but Katie spells it out in detail and does so masterfully. Katie is at Town Hall. Yes, Town Hall. She's the editor there. She's a graduate from, is it Arizona, Katie?
Yes, the University of Arizona.
University of Arizona. I'm a USC fan, so we won't hold that against you. Katie, let's get right down to things. This Fast and Furious, your book, the entire Fast and Furious, it reads like the movie Casino. It's about greed, deception, money, power, murder, corruption, and Ace Rothstein, who was at the casino, who the movie was about, for those that are familiar with it, was the head of food and beverage, but that was because he couldn't get a license because of his criminal activity. He couldn't get licensed to be the official head, so they would put him in as something else, and he would stay there for a number of years. I think it was 10 years he could be in one position, and then they would simply change the title and let the process start all over again. That seems to be what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with something that, as we start in the beginning, Obama, Holder, and Hillary Clinton make statements that they are going to put an end to guns being taken across the border, and also that they are going to in a clandestine way disaffect the people in the Second Amendment. Why don't you take it from there and introduce us to your work?
Right. Well, just for a little background on what Operation Fast and Furious was, if people aren't familiar, I'll give them the listeners what the claims of the program were, and then we'll get into what they actually were. The Justice Department claimed they were going to allow guns to be purchased by men who were working for Mexican cartels and allow those men to transfer those weapons. We're talking AK-47s, 50-caliber rifles. Keep in mind, a 50-caliber can take down a helicopter. And their goal was to allow these guns to go into the highest levels of the cartel in order to take down this extensive cartel network and see who the top guys and who was leading the cartel. The big fish is what they claimed it would be. But the problem is, after allowing 2,500 weapons to cross the border, out of all of those weapons, thousands of weapons, only two of them had GPS recording devices on them. Two out of 2,500. Now, if you break that down, that's 0.0008% of these guns had tracking devices. That's not a very serious tracking program, if you ask me. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why did they implement a program where they were giving really high-powered weapons to the very cartels that not only Mexico was trying to fight, but that the President Obama himself made a top priority at the beginning of his administration? You go back to the spring of 2009, the Obama administration is brand new, fresh and new, and President Obama, Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder were all pushing this 90% figure, that 90% of guns in Mexico are coming from mom-and-pop gun stores. And President Obama has a long, long history of being a full approval of the Clinton-era assault weapons ban. As soon as Eric Holder got into office as the Attorney General, he said that he wanted to reinstate that ban. And Hillary Clinton, of course, is also a fan of the assault rifle ban. But it turns out that 90% of guns in Mexico actually aren't coming from the United States. They're not coming from mom-and-pop gun dealers. The State Department's own cables show and prove that these cartels aren't coming to America to get their weapons. They're getting them in China, or out of China. They're getting them from cheaper sources in Central America. They're not getting them from our gun dealers here in the United States. So instead of taking a step back and saying, look, we can no longer push for more regulation and more weapons bans based on this 90% figure because it's not true, they said, well, let's instead flood Mexico with guns that actually are coming from gun dealers into the United States. So what happened? They approached the Justice Department with ATF. ATF agents approached gun dealers in Arizona, law-abiding gun dealers, I might add, and said, look, we need you to help your country by selling to these cartel members. These straw purchasers are going to come in. They're going to come in with false ID. They're going to come in with cash. It's okay. Sell to them anyway. They're going to purchase large orders of AK-47s and high-powered weapons like 50 calibers. Go ahead and sell to them. Don't worry. They were lied to and told that these guys would be arrested. They were lied to and told these guns would never go to Mexico. And in the end, hundreds of bodies later, we find out that the entire reason why they wanted these gun dealers to sell to these cartel members in the first place is because they wanted to prove that guns were coming from American gun shops and ending up at blood-soaked crime scenes in Mexico in order to come back again and say, we need more regulations on American gun dealers because they are the ones responsible for the murder and mayhem in Mexico when all along it was the government forcing them to sell.
So from the very beginning, then it's safe to say that the plan was never to impact or make a difference with the drug cartels. It was always to change the power of the Second Amendment here for Americans to own and bear arms. Is that a fair assessment?
No, absolutely. I mean, you go back to testimony from whistleblowers, and you say, you know, you listen to what they say, and there's nothing that drives these guys, everything on the line, in order to come out and tell us the truth about this. They've been retaliated against. Their lives been turned upside down. There's nothing that drives them crazier than when they hear the media say that this was a botched operation, that this was a mistake, that somehow thousands of weapons ended up in the hands of the wrong people. When you look at the testimony of John Dodson, who was the first ATF special agent to come out publicly and said, you know, he said, allowing loads of weapons that we knew were destined for criminals, this was the plan. It was mandated. And so this wasn't a case of they accidentally lost track of thousands of guns. Their goal from the beginning was to get them into the hands of cartels in order to blame these gun shops for the violence.
Well, I find it interesting that this was the first step, the first major initiative that Obama undertook after he was inaugurated. He was inaugurated at the end of January, and in early February, the second week of February or thereabouts, he was initiating and calling for this first and furious to supposedly fight drug cartels, and he had Eric Holder and Hillary Clinton on board with him. I'm going to come back to some of the players, and I'm going to come back to the outcomes of this and what went on and the lies told to the gun dealers and their feeling uncomfortable in breaking the law, knowingly breaking the law, and also come back to what happened with the whistleblowers. But I want to spend some time on Obama, Holder, and Clinton. I have long said that there is no way with the international repercussions that this that this could send, the shock waves that this could send, there was no way that the three of them, the president, the head of the State Department, and the head of the Justice Department, did not know and sign off on what was taking place with Fast and Furious. If this isn't Charlie Wilson's war, you don't have some rogue senator going to committee, getting money, and then having chasing the Russians out of Afghanistan. This is something very serious with deep international repercussions, and those three were involved up to their necks, and yet there's nothing done. I mean, we've had committee meeting after committee meeting. We've passed the May 30th where I think it was Chaffetz said that Congressman Chaffetz said that there would be contempt of Congress action taken if Holder didn't give the papers and so forth. That hasn't been done. And it very much looks like these three people who there's no arguable way that they did not know what was taking place, especially when we read on page 28, and it says, Ogden said, the president has directed us to take action to fight these cartels, and Attorney General Eric Holder and I are taking several new and aggressive steps as part of the administration's comprehensive plan. That's pretty damning, if you ask me.
Right, and you go into, in the book I do this specifically because we haven't really seen this yet in the normal press, or we haven't really seen a whole lot about Fast and Furious in general, but we've really only seen the surface details about who was involved in Fast and Furious. We've heard these generalized statements about DOJ, the Justice Department, Homeland Security, the White House, the State Department, but we haven't really heard about who are these people. And you have to keep in mind that even today, the Justice Department is saying, you know, senior officials, despite approving wiretap applications, which wiretap applications require that you submit very, very detailed information about a case because it's the last line of resort in law enforcement because it's so invasive, they still deny that they knew anything about these tactics. When you look into it, Eric Holder has changed his testimony multiple times under oath in front of Congress. You know, in May 2011, he said that he knew about Fast and Furious for a couple of weeks when President Obama had testified months before, not testified, but in an interview with Univision, had said that he, you know, found out about it and was talking about Eric Holder's role a little bit in it in March, and that's months before May. And so then all of a sudden, Eric Holder gets caught with, you know, there's memos that show that he knew nearly a year before he admitted he knew a few weeks before May. And then it just so happens that he's going to say, well, I knew in February, which was a month before President Obama knew. So there's a little bit of correlation there in terms of the timing. But you dig into who the people were on the ground. And there's one guy who is very crucial to connecting all of the dots here. Mm-hmm. And we haven't really heard that much about him. His name is Dennis Burke, and he's the former U.S. attorney for Arizona who was in charge and in full approval of memo show that of Fast and Furious and gunwalking tactics on the ground. He was the one in Arizona saying from the DOJ side, this is great, keep going. Well, it just so happens that Dennis Burke worked as Janet Napolitano's staffer when she was the Attorney General for Arizona. He was Janet Napolitano's chief of staff during her time as governor of Arizona for 7 years before following her into the Obama administration as her senior Homeland Security advisor before President Obama strategically placed him back in Arizona. Now, why do I say strategically? I say strategically because Arizona is a border state and Arizona is a pro-Second Amendment state, so it's very easy for this administration to blame Mexican cartel violence on gun dealers in Arizona. Well, it just so happens that President Obama appoints Dennis Burke as the U.S. Attorney for Arizona. Dennis Burke is from Chicago and just so happened to have wrote up the Clinton-era assault weapons ban legislation with Rahm Emanuel, who, of course, served as President Obama's chief of staff before going back to being the mayor of Chicago. Now, at the same time that Dennis Burke was serving as U.S. attorney in Arizona, he was sitting on Eric Holder's Attorney General's Advisory Board, giving him direct advice as to gun trafficking policy and border policy in general. Yet none of them claim that they ever talked to each other, and all of them claim that they didn't know anything about Fast and Furious while it was going on.
Not to mention
denying that it was ever anything, implemented to attack the Second Amendment.
And then tripping over one another's statements and stories, including Obama's now infamous interview with Gibson when he changed when the stories were changed about him, what he saw or approved, and so forth. We have that involvement, Katie, but how does Congress or the courts or whomever, how do they navigate through this to get to these people? John Gotti went to prison for less than these people are guilty of. I mean, we're looking at murder. We're looking at Brian Terry. We're looking at Avila that was brutally murdered by the cartel. We're looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of innocent Mexicans that have been slaughtered thus far, and even probably more today. We're looking at the Mexican Attorney General Gonzalez, her brother being killed. We're looking at these things taking place, and Obama is sitting in his ivory tower. Hillary's getting drunk, drinking beer, dancing on the floor in a foreign country, not a pleasant sight. And we have Holder, who's stumbling over story after story after lie, and we go back to when the Republicans, or the 21 Republicans, they didn't even want him confirmed as Attorney General. I mean, what's going on? Who's doing what? I mean, committee hearings, in the big picture, accomplish little. I mean, it's a lot of talk, it's a lot of bravado, it's a lot of blustering, it's a lot of point making and theater, kabuki theater, but committee meetings really in the long run do not accomplish much. And when they talk about, well, we want him to resign, resigning isn't an option for me. I want to see him indicted. How do we go about that? Why is this taking so long? Why is there not more? I mean, we've got people whose careers have been threatened and ruined, Ogden. And I'd like for you to talk about him and what he did in bringing down Hell's Angels, and how he risked his life and was away from his family for so many years. It's that deep undercover, and yet they threw him to the wolves, and from what I read, intentionally put him in harm's way when they deemed him a threat. How do we get to these people and say, okay, enough? Does it take you writing another book? Does it take me writing and talking and screaming to people about it? What does it take?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the thing, is Congress can only do so much, and yes, I agree that committee hearings only have so much power. However, when you break it down, committee hearings actually do have a lot of power in terms of Eric Holder changing his testimony under oath, right? That could potentially be a perjury charge for him, not to mention other things like obstruction of justice and other charges that we have yet to see. And so when you look at it that way, it's a good thing. And also it allows, the press who are willing to cover this to go to Capitol Hill and shed some light on this rather than all of the negotiations being taken place behind closed doors. But the issue here in terms of what we can do, look, the mainstream media, the liberal media, has made it very clear that they are not interested in covering the scandal. I guarantee you, if it was a Republican president, it would be front page news all day, every single day, but it's not. But this is the issue, is there's nothing louder than the voice of the American people. And that takes, them going to protest. And when Eric Holder shows up at a place to say, what about this topic and why aren't you coming clean about this, calling your congressman. And in terms of the legalities, look, Watergate took 3 years. And Watergate wasn't as complicated as Fast and Furious. We didn't have anyone killed during Watergate. It was a pretty straightforward scandal when you really look into it. And so that took 3 years, and so we're in year one now of the Fast and Furious investigation. There's a lot of high-profile people involved. You know, President Obama's entire top tier of his Justice Department are looking at possible criminal charges. And just today, Congressman Issa came out with a letter that he sent to Eric Holder, and I'll read it to you at the end. And he says, quote, "The new information contained in wiretap application places us in a position to begin the process of assigning accountability among senior department officials, some of whom were responsible for approving the wiretap applications. After having reviewed these applications, we now understand why the department has been resisting our efforts to secure full cooperation and compliance with the subpoena. It is because, as former ATF Acting Director Kenneth Melson testified, it appears thoroughly to us that the department is really trying to figure out a way to push the information away from the political appointees in the Justice Department." And so,
Katie, let me interrupt you. Forgive me, but let me interrupt you right there, and please hold your thought. That's excellent. That's a tremendous step by Dale Issa. But then you have the continued rumors and drumbeats that John Boehner, Eric Cantor, and McCarthy are working behind the scenes to have this thing just go away. And also, add to that, there's a rumor that Boehner is working to have this go away because he doesn't want to come before the media with all of, have the media latch onto this, and he's trying to use Trayvon Martin as a blind or a cover to make it go away because he's afraid of black outcry that the black radicals, if you will, would be upset and he would be castigated in the press, and that's one of the reasons that he's working behind the scenes to make this go away. And as early as far back as late fall, I was hearing that Boehner was causing a stall with the investigation. What about that?
Right. I mean, there has been a little headbutting when it comes to, you know, the leadership here. But the bottom line is that, I think it was 3 weeks ago now, all of the House leadership, John Boehner, Eric Cantor, and McCarthy, all sent a letter with Daryl Issa to the Justice Department saying, look, it's time to come clean here. And they wouldn't have done that if they were trying to shut the investigation down. Everyone I've talked to has said that John Boehner is in full approval of what Issa's doing, that he's just kind of, he's not out front because it's not his investigation, it's Congressman Issa's investigation. But that doesn't mean that he's not being supportive. And so, yes, there has been a little bit of pushback in terms of what the political implications of this will be, but Issa has made his case that this is too important. There are too many people involved. There are too many laws that have been broken. There's too much criminal activity that has taken place in the executive branch. We have a dead Border Patrol agent whose family has no answers as to what happened. And so he's not going to stop until we have more of the answers that we need. And I can guarantee you that leadership wouldn't have sent that letter to the Justice Department if they weren't serious about getting to the bottom of this. And the bottom line is, too, that Eric Holder and this administration in general have put themselves in a very, very sticky situation because if they come, you know, the Oversight Committee and Chairman Issa and even John Boehner have given Eric Holder a certain amount of time to comply with the subpoena that was issued in October before they move forward with contempt charges. Well, Eric Holder, he can either move forward and comply with the subpoena and submit information to Congress that probably has some conflicting information in there with his own testimony, or he can take a political hit, which would be bad for the administration and bad for Eric Holder and the Justice Department as a whole. And so they put themselves in this position where Eric Holder is essentially testifying against himself because he's had to lie and cover up for a year now in front of Congress. And so if he submits information that was requested in subpoena, he could definitely implicate himself like he has in other situations because lies are hard to keep track of. Or he's going to make it a politically bad situation for President Obama, who he's very good friends with, just before his reelection campaign.
But the thing is that this isn't really a blip on the radar screen in terms of what the public is hearing from the media. I mean, it wasn't the media that broke the story. It was the as you point out, it was the bloggers. And I want to say to everyone that's listening, people say to me, write me and they call me, say several times a day, literally, what can we do? We feel so helpless. Well, I tell them the same thing. Don't stop calling. Don't stop writing. Don't send emails. Send letters, because when you send mail, they have to open it. But, you know, stay involved. Keep sending the stories around. Call radio shows. Get involved. It was bloggers that broke this story, just like it was bloggers that were responsible for breaking the truth about the fraud that Dan Rather was committing against President Bush and his National Guard service.
Right.
So the bloggers did the job, but the media remained silent on it.
Mm-hmm.
I just turn on Fox News. Exactly. So if Obama is able to pick up the phone and have his office, or he himself will have his office call the news and say, look, we're upset with the way, and I'm sorry, I forget her name, CBS reporter.
Cheryl Atkinson. Mm-hmm.
Atkinson, yes, Cheryl. If they were able to shut her down, and this is a CBS reporter. She was the only mainstream media person that had enough integrity or curiosity or professional instincts, call it whatever, to pursue this, and the Obama administration shut her down.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
right.
Who's going to chase with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the key, is this. You know, it's easy to feel helpless and like you can't do anything, but the truth is that just – simply word of mouth gets a lot going, and this is a scandal that speaks for itself. The fact is that this administration was willing to use humans as collateral damage to push an unpopular anti-Second Amendment policy position around Congress and behind the backs of the American people while they left people dead in the wake, and they didn't care. And ever since day one, ever since the day Brian Terry was killed, not when the press got a hold of this and people started figuring out what was going on, the night Brian Terry was killed is when the cover-up began. And I always talk about Fast and Furious as a scandal with many scandals underneath. I mean, this isn't just one scandal of one thing. It's a scandal with many, and I talk about it this way because whether it's Brian Terry being murdered with using weapons that were given to these thugs south of the border, the very same thugs that we hear about, heard about 3 weeks ago, who dumped headless, handless, feetless bodies on the side of the road, including women. Those are the kind of people that this Justice Department was willing to give guns, who of course come right back up north of the border because the border isn't secure, use them against our own law enforcement agents. We're lucky that not more Border Patrol agents were killed that night. Brian Terry is dead. They covered up his crime scene. All of the DOJ senior officials involved have said they knew nothing about it. It's a scandal that Eric Holder's changed his testimony multiple times under oath in front of Congress. It's a scandal that this was a program set up in order to attack the Second Amendment because it's an unpopular thing to do. It's a scandal because this is an administration that was willing to sacrifice what they would call a few for the greater good of what they think is America with more gun control laws. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
And then you had, and to that, that's just tremendous detail. And I feel your passion in this, and I just give you a big Marine hoorah for that. I mean, this is what the listeners need to hear. They need to understand what you have just said. They need to get your book. They can pick it up right on my website, michael-matthew.com. It's there. Read it. They need to listen to what you're saying today, and they need to hear me when I say they are the power. It's going to take them to advance this, because Boehner's not going to go any further than he thinks he can go without being criticized in the press. Obama and his people are going to lie, obfuscate, and let some lowly clerks into booth, if you will, be fired and go to jail for it. And speaking of going to jail, you say, both in the book and, of course, we've heard it as well, that Janet Napolitano seems to be the person most likely the first to go to jail.
Well, I think they all. I think Eric Holder, Janet Napolitano, I think they both equally have a greater chance of going to prison. But the reason I say that is because the sources I talked to on the ground said, look, she's lying when she says under oath that she didn't know about Fast and Furious while it was going on. And that's because every single report that ATF filed with DOJ and ATF headquarters about the program was also filed with ICE and DHS headquarters in Washington, D.C. Janet Napolitano also claims she never talked to Eric Holder about Fast and Furious. They haven't been in contact at all about the scandal when Janet Napolitano knew all about the Secret Service scandal and was in the weeds with that, yet she has no idea what happened when it came to one of her Border Patrol agents being killed as a result of a DOJ program. She claims they never talked. Sources say that they did talk and they've been in communication. And then going back to kind of the beginning of the show, when I talked about Dennis Burke. I mean, Dennis Burke connects these two so closely that there's no way that that all three of them weren't in contact, but especially Janet Napolitano and Eric Holder when it comes to this. And then, once again, you go back to the beginning of the Obama administration, and President Obama gave Eric Holder direct orders to work with Janet Napolitano in stopping gun trafficking policy south of the border into Mexico. And so you add up all those dots and there's just, you know, her continued stance of I knew nothing about this, I'm not giving any details, isn't going to fly for much longer.
And the very fact that Obama gave his tacit, not just his tacit stamp of approval, but gave the power of his office to legitimize this, he authorized this, and then boasted as much as boasted about it to the Mexican president Calderon. He's mentioned it here, and yet there's an eerie silence about his involvement. How is
right.
that?
Well, I mean, you have, you know, like we talked about, you have the press circulating the wagons around this president. And this administration is a genius when it comes to deflecting the blame away from the president and onto someone else, or even just distracting away. I mean, we heard the let's blame Bush argument, not just with the economy, but also with Fast and Furious. As soon as, you know, the paper trail started leading up to senior DOJ officials knowing all about the tactics used in this program, of course, what do? They resort to saying, well, it was Bush's fault. And so, you know, President Obama's done a really good job of trying to, you know, keep away from the scandal when all the evidence shows that they knew about it. I mean, you look at the fact that Kevin O'Reilly, who was a national security staffer at the White House, was in contact with the special agent in charge of the Phoenix ATF office, Bill Newell, about Fast and Furious. You know, he was in the White House. Kevin O'Reilly was in the White House. And as soon as we found out that he was in contact with the ATF Phoenix office, guess what happened? Kevin O'Reilly was shipped off to Iraq and told, you know, and the Oversight Committee was told that he was unavailable for comment or interview, even as a private citizen and not as a national security staff member. Not to mention that President Obama's senior advisor to Latin America on the national security team at the White House was also forwarded emails about Fast and Furious. And yet President Obama claims he never knew anything about this, despite making gun trafficking policy a top priority and one of the first things he took on in his administration.
Well, and it was one of the first things, if not the first thing. It was he took this on approximately 3 weeks, if I do the math correctly. He was inaugurated on the 20th or whatever of January. Actually, I guess it was a little later than that, a day or two later, because they didn't have the Bible or whatever he was going to be place his hand on. And I believe it was February 17th that he was making statements about authorizing this. So this was probably the first thing that he went after. But who else might there be behind the scenes? I mean, we hear a lot of talk about Obama being controlled by this one and controlled by that one and so forth. I think it would be good that we could either dispel that or say, well, possibly there's this or that one that's behind this or that's pushing Obama to do that, or is this in your opinion, Obama's baby, if you will?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And whether it just comes down to, look, I think Rahm Emanuel actually had a huge involvement in the scandal that we just don't quite know about yet. I mean, I explained earlier that he helped craft the Clinton-era assault weapons ban with Dennis Burke, who was the main frontman at Fast and Furious on the ground level in Arizona. And Rahm Emanuel knew that going up into the 2010 midterm elections that they probably shouldn't be taking on gun control as an issue in President Obama's first term. But Rahm Emanuel is also responsible for saying, you know, never let a crisis go to waste. Well, there's a crisis on our southern border with violence in Mexico, and they were going to use that to their advantage and say, look, we're fueling this horrific, you know, murderous drug war in Mexico, not only by our consumption of drugs, but by also sending guns into Mexico, which, like I explained, isn't true. But I think Rahm Emanuel had a big part in it, and he knew that discussing the issues of bringing up a new assault weapons ban would hurt President Obama even more in the 2010 midterm elections than it already did, because you look at what happened in 1994. I mean, there was an overwhelming turnover in the House because of that legislation. And so they decided to do things under the radar and through regulation rather than legislation and the involvement of Congress. And this administration is notorious for not wanting to work with Congress, kind of saying that President Obama and the executive branch is the end-all, be-all, and that what they're going to do is what goes. And you look at what happened last summer. You know, the Justice Department pushed through new gun regulations through the Justice Department and justified it by pointing to Fast and Furious, even though the new gun regulations wouldn't have helped in this case in the first place. And so you look at that, and then you look at the sources I talked to in the book, and they say, look, this was about setting up these gun dealers from the beginning. They knew they weren't going to be able to legislate them out of business, so they regulated them out of business. From the beginning, there was this huge conflict of interest because ATF controls whether these gun dealers operate on a regular basis, right? They control their license.
Right.
And so ATF would walk, sure, you don't want to, you know, help us with this investigation, because we know that we put food on your table by whether we decide that you get your license or not. And so these gun dealers were kind of forced into the situation where they were lied to and told that these guns wouldn't be falling into the wrong hands, be put in the wrong hands. They were lied to when they were told that the guys buying the guns would be arrested. And they were lied to when they said that no one would get hurt, when after hundreds of people have been slaughtered in Mexico and our federal agents have been murdered as a result, these gun dealers are the ones who got thrown under the bus. Interestingly enough, on December 15, 2010, which is the same day Brian Terry was killed, the Washington Post came out with this huge expose about the secret life of guns, and it was all about how gun dealers in Arizona were responsible for fueling the drug war and the violence in Mexico. Well, the very same officials, including Bill Newell, who are quoted in that story, were the same officials who were slamming gun dealers publicly while behind closed doors they were telling them to sell. They were smearing them publicly in speeches. They were smearing them publicly in the press, when all along their goal was to make it look like these gun dealers were the problem and that they needed more regulation as a result.
We see again, Katie, you're just spot on. We see the depth of corruption and intrigue that our government, the people, the persons in office that America has elected and trust. I mean, we're talking about the person that has ads running about what he's done for America. We're talking about the chief law enforcement officer in the land, in Eric Holder, being corrupt, threatening his own people. I mean, forget that. And we see a pattern. We see a systematic pattern of this going back even before J. Christian Adams, who broke the story about the new Black Panthers. We see this type of behavior taking place, And if it weren't for you writing a book like this and then making time out of your nonchalant, easygoing, nothing really busy to do day to spend an hour with them explaining all of this, and when we walk away, you're still saying, my goodness, this is what you and I do literally 24/7. But the American public that gets sound bites and snippets, this is so critical. And one of the things that I want to come back around to, and perhaps you can address, is what this says, what this points to, pursuant to the depth of corruption in this administration. And we can point, I'm 1 or 2 hours older than you are, so it would be hard for me to go back really far, but we can point to corrupt administrations quite easily. But there is no administration that I can point to that is as corrupt and Machiavellian and dishonest as this administration, and Fast and Furious is just the tip of the iceberg. What say you?
I would say so. And the thing is I sat in hearings. I've been to every single hearing that Eric Holder has been at, and every Fast and Furious hearing they've had so far. And I just remember last summer when this whole thing was getting going, and sitting there in June and July, and thinking and listening and thinking, this is it. This is as corrupt as it gets. I'm sitting in a room where people have no problem with lying. They're not going to admit that their program, you know, resulted in the murders of innocent people. And then not to mention being in the room with Eric Holder in October and the arrogance that was seething from him in terms of Senator Cornyn, John Cornyn from Texas. This was nearly a year after Brian Terry was killed. Senator Cornyn asked Eric Holder, have you spoken to the family? Have you apologized to the family? And
yeah.
Eric Holder said no. He hadn't.
He hadn't even spoken to the family. Almost nonchalantly.
Yeah, no big deal. And then because, you know, that caused a little bit of a stir with the public relations side of the Justice Department, what did Eric Holder do? He issued an apology, but leaked it to the press before the entire family had a chance to read it first. So really, he wasn't apologizing because he felt like he should. He was apologizing because John Cornyn made him look bad by asking him that question. And then you fast forward to February, and Eric Holder once again is sitting in front of the House Oversight Committee testifying about Fast and Furious, and John Dodson, the whistleblower, one of the first guys to come forward, whose life has been turned completely upside down. He's been transferred. He's been retaliated against. He's not welcome in ATF circles anymore for exposing the truth about this program. John Dodson was there. I don't think Eric Holder knew he was going to be there. They walked up to him. It was one of the most tense moments I think I've ever seen in my life. And once Chairman Issa, got the committee hearing started, he asked Eric Holder if he had even talked to any of the whistleblowers, and because they've been having some major issues with the Justice Department and retaliation. And Eric Holder had the nerve to respond and say, if they need to contact me, they can call me if they have a problem. As if they'd ever be able to get a hold of him directly.
Exactly. And what happens, two-part question. One, what happened to the legislation and the promises that candidate Obama made to protect the whistleblowers? What happened to the congressional legislation that was drafted and passed, what 1989 or thereabouts, shortly thereafter, to protect whistleblowers? And what happens, that's question one, and question two, what happens if Obama loses? Does this investigation go on, or does it go away? If Holder is forced to resign, is that the end of it, or does he still face criminal charges? If Napolitano steps down, does she still face charges? I mean, how does all of this work out? Those are two questions.
Well, and this is something you asked earlier about what people can do to move the ball forward, right? Calling Mitt Romney's campaign and making Fast and Furious one of his top campaign subjects is key. He brought it up at the NRA convention in St. Louis back in April. He mentioned it briefly in a speech there, which I thought was great because it elevated the scandal to a presidential national level that we hadn't seen before. And, you know, people can say, well, it's we can't get bogged down in one scandal, but like we just talked about, this is about the corruption and the arrogance and the idea that the President of the United States and the Attorney General and Janet Napolitano all believe that they're above the law. And so if you really want to do something about this, call Mitt Romney's campaign and say, look, this is something that we're interested in. This is something that needs to be taken care of, especially if you're coming to Washington to change things and get rid of the corruption that's already there.
And that's exactly what it takes. It takes a continued banging on the door before someone opens it enough for the sound and the peep out to who it is and to let us in. This will go away if you the people, we the people, do not pursue it. It will go away.
Because it's very important to keep pushing.
This is corruption on a level that, as I said, and I'm not being overly dramatic, this is corruption on a level that I have not seen in my political life. I mean, and I've been at it since 1972. This is corruption beyond anything that I've ever seen. That said, Katie, why is it? Do you reason that Obama is so interested in getting rid of guns, especially getting guns out of the inner city, as you point out in your book? He's almost manic to rid the inner cities of guns. And you made reference to, I believe it was his grandmother who mentioned white men came with guns and things. But what is it that's motivating him to rid the country of guns for you and I?
I think it's a couple of things. I think that he doesn't really understand the way that gun control works. You know, when you implement more gun control at the level of you're punishing law-abiding citizens and trampling on their Second Amendment rights and not allowing them to defend themselves, you're really advocating for criminals who really don't care about the law anyway. And if you want an example of how gun control hasn't worked, you can look at President Obama's hometown of Chicago and the violence that rages there because no one is capable of defending themselves legally against criminals who roam the streets day and night. And President Obama, and this is something I do in the book extensively, and Eric Holder as well, they have very long histories of being anti-Second Amendment, anti-gun. And, you know, it can be, you could argue, you know, ignorance, but I think it just really comes down to President Obama and Eric Holder are both politicians and bureaucrats who believe that more control by the government is better. And there's a reason why the founding fathers put the Second Amendment into the Constitution, because when you take away, you know, the people's right to defend themselves and their property and the government has more control, well, overall you have more control. And right now, as it stands, you know, the American people still have a lot of control. And when you want the government to be, you know, the dependence of the people, you have to take away things that make them independent from it. So I think it really just comes down to a mindset of more government is better, and an armed, republic doesn't allow them to do that.
Which is spelled M-A-R-X-I-S-T in my book. But you mentioned
one more thing real quickly on
that point.
You know, President Obama in general has been very anti-American in the sense of he doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. You know, we've seen him say that. And he wants us to be just like the rest of the world. And the Second Amendment is something that makes America very different from the rest of the world. There are very few countries, and there are no countries, that really allow you to carry a gun like the United States. Switzerland might be the only exception. And so it's an exceptional thing. The Second Amendment is a very exceptional, unique thing. And if President Obama's goal is to break the United States down and make us just like every other country, well, you have to take the Second Amendment away to do that.
Precisely. And, Katie, we're nearly out of time, but I do want to go back and talk about Mexico. We know that the guns are in Mexico. As you point out, there are approximately 1,400 guns more, probably more, that we just don't know about that are missing. That said, what are the chances? What is the likelihood that these guns will end up not just having murdered people in Mexico and in the United States and in Arizona, but in other places around the world? Guns are like a bad penny. I mean, a bad gun has a way of showing up in a variety of places. What happens if one of these guns or more of these guns start turning up in other areas of the world where people are killed by them, murdered by them? What are the chances? Is there a possibility that a complaint to the United Nations comes back to puts the United Nations or puts us in the crosshairs of the UN? Is there a likelihood or is there a possibility that a foreign nation could threaten to bring whatever charges they're able to bring to the United States against the various departments in this country, including the Oval Office, that would force Obama into making some type of a backdoor, backroom deal to safeguard things? How do you see that?
Well, the fact is that you talk to any law enforcement officer, local, state, federal, and they will tell you that you do not allow guns to walk. You do not give guns to criminals because they kill people with them. It's a very common practice not to allow guns to walk. You know, gun walking in this case was what, you know, President Obama would call unprecedented. And it's not something that is used for that exact reason. And Eric Holder is not willing to admit very many things, but he is willing to admit that as a result of this program, we will see numerous murders as a result for years and years to come. And now your question about the UN, well, yeah, this just gives the UN, another talking point and more ammunition in terms of attacking the Second Amendment. Right now in July, the UN Small Arms Treaty, which President Obama, Eric Holder, and Hillary Clinton are all for because it gives the international community say over whether Americans can buy certain things and bear certain arms. And we're not talking, big military gear here. We're talking about the kind of ammunition that we use, the kind of side arms that we use, the kind of hunting rifles that we use. And so this gives the UN another excuse to say, well, your country is funding the drug war. Obviously, we need to have more regulation and have more control over what the American people are doing because you're clearly not doing it yourself.
And that allows them to the United States or under this administration to say, you're right, we bow to you, and we're going to take guns from the people, or attempt to at any rate. What happens if Obama gets reelected?
This is the thing. Is one thing that people aren't really talking about at all yet either is the Supreme Court. Now, President Obama, if he's reelected, may have a chance to appoint three new justices, which would swing the court to his way, and so he would have the ability to implement his fantasy of anti-Second Amendment policy positions from the Supreme Court, legislating from the Supreme Court. Should he get a second term. And you have to remember that President Obama likes flexibility, and he's more than willing to be flexible when it comes to anti-Second Amendment policy positions, whether it's through legislation or regulation. In this case, it would probably be more regulation, and he would utilize his departments and utilize his czars to push his anti-Second Amendment policy positions through in a second term where he doesn't have to worry about things like midterm elections or even an election for the presidency. So things could get really bad really quickly with his Second Amendment stance.
Well, actually, it's only one justice would potentially swing the court. That would be Kennedy. And I seem to remember Kennedy saying that he wasn't going to retire as long as Obama was in office. As I recall,
Any of them could drop dead any day.
Which I was going to say as well.
Right.
Yeah. that which would make, which could be very damning for us. Katie, you've been an exceptional guest. I would like to be able to go further. We're up against the end of our time. I've pretty much let you just go again. You've been excellent. What would you like to say in wrapping things up?
Just, if you don't believe that the President of the United States and the Attorney General are above the law, you need to read the book. You need to spread the story. Get the book. Pass it to your neighbor. Just spread the word, and there's nothing more powerful than the voice of the American people. And if you want something to be done about this, you have to be the one to do it. Don't rely on other people.
And people can find you where?
Townhall.com, and you can also find the book on Amazon.com at Barnes & Noble.
Good enough. Thank you, Katie. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. I want to thank Katie Pavlich for being with us with her excellent book on It's Fast and Furious, Barack Obama's Bloodiest Scandal and Its Shameless Cover-Up. It's an eye-opening book. If you read this book and you're not as upset as I was, or you don't feel the passion and angst in the voice that was shared in Katie's voice, check your heartbeat. This is a very real problem, and it's a problem that we the people must encourage the lawmakers to resolve and to stay after. And as Katie said, we have to get to the ones that are running for office now and say, look, Fast and Furious is a major issue. It's a significant point of concern for us, and we want you to stay on it. As long as this stays silent, it goes away. And we're talking about the Oval Office, we're talking about the head of the State Department, we're talking about the head of the Department of Justice, we're talking about the head of Homeland Security. The four major heads of our government that are involved in a criminal activity that they can no longer deny. They can only hope they can obfuscate and slow down and have go away because the attention of the people is not there. So grab the book. As Katie said, you can get it at Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at michael-massey.com. And I want to thank you all for joining. This is Michael Massey. Thank you for being with Michael Massey. Or I should say michael-massey.com.